I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about racism. We're going to talk about what produces racial animosity and ways we can work through it. We're going to talk about how we get past hate. My guests will be author and civil rights activist Daryl Davis, who has worked successfully to change the minds of white supremacists, and Scott Shepard, a former KKK member who now works to create racial peace. Please join the conversation. Call 1-866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is nolimits@WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by your membership and by Apparatus IT Security, identifying network vulnerabilities to help keep companies secure. More information on security assessments for businesses at apparatus.net. And by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th State University. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about erasing racial barriers. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is nolimits@WFYI. Well, I'm joined today by Daryl Davis, who is an author and a civil rights activist, is here to speak tonight at Franklin College. Daryl, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
It's good to have you here. We're also joined by Scott Shepard, who is a former member of the KKK and now works to achieve racial peace. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
It's good to have both of you here. And I think probably to bring the audience in, we need to start a little bit with backstories and talk a little bit. Scott, I'm going to ask you in a few minutes about your journey to the KKK and then your journey away from it. But I think the far more interesting story is that there is some precedent of obviously Caucasian Americans embracing the KKK, very little of African Americans embracing the KKK and attempting to reach out to it in ways that willingly. So, Daryl, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the path that brought you into these kind of reconciliation efforts where you were reaching out to white supremacist groups.
Well, you know, as a child, my parents were in the Foreign Service, so I spent a lot of time overseas, and I grew up with kids in school, in elementary school, back in the 60s, from all over the world. And as a result of that, I never really experienced a lot of racism until I would come home to my own country after, you know, one of the assignments from being overseas, and I began to notice how people, you know, were separated by race, and it always bothered me, and my burning question was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And so later on, you know, I would study it on my own and increase my knowledge of it. And then I decided, you know, I had to have the answer. So who better to ask than somebody who would join an organization who practiced that? You know, why not ask them, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And as a result of doing that, I found that even though they hated me while I was sitting there talking with them, over a period of time, some of these people became truly, honestly, good friends of mine and left the organization.
How did you start out doing that at first? I mean, so many of the, you know, sort of the cultural it's counterintuitive, I guess, in a way, your approach. How did you make the initial reaching out to white supremacist groups?
Well,
and I know you've told this story in a book.
It kind of happened as a fluke the first time around. 1983, I was playing in a country western band. Country music had made a resurgence in this country with a movie called Urban Cowboy. A lot of live music joints had crossed over the country. And I was the only black guy in this band, and consequently the only black guy in many of the places where we would play. And this one truck stop, I was playing in Frederick, Maryland, I just finished a set and came off the bandstand with the band, and I was going to go sit down, and this gentleman got up from his table and walked across the dance floor and put his arm around my shoulder and said, you know, this is the first time I ever heard a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. And I wasn't trying to be facetious or anything like that. I was kind of taken aback, like, you know, didn't this guy know? And I said to him, you know, well, where do you think Jerry Lee learned how to play? And he said, what are you talking about? I said, well, Jerry Lee Lewis learned that style from the same place I did, from black, blues, and boogie-woogie piano players. Well, the guy wanted to argue with me that Jerry Lee invented that and he didn't learn anything from black people. I told the man, you know, I know Jerry Lee Lewis personally. He's a good friend of mine. He's told me himself where he learned how to play. And the guy didn't buy it, but he wanted to buy me a drink. And I had a cranberry juice with him, and turns out he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and he was fascinated that this black guy could play that kind of music. And he gave me his number and wanted me to call him anytime I was to come back to this bar so he could bring some of his friends, his Klan buddies, Klansmen and Klanswomen, to see this black guy play piano like Jerry Lee. So I'd call him every 6 weeks, you know, when we were there at the bar for the weekend, and he'd come and he'd bring them. Some of them would talk to me. Some of them were kind of standoffish, you know, didn't want anything to do with me, just kind of watch me from afar. So later on, I left that band at the end of 83 and went back to playing rock and roll and whatever else was going on in 1984. But 8 years later, I decided I wanted to write my book. And so I contacted him, and I convinced him to give me the phone number for the Grand Dragon for the state of Maryland. And give me the guy's address. I would go to his house and see if I can get an interview. Well, he didn't want to give me the information, but he finally gave it to me on the condition that I not reveal where I got it from. And he warned me. He said, don't go to his house. He'll kill you. So I had my secretary call him and set up an interview. So that's how that all took place. And then later on, it turns out, you know, this guy became a good friend of mine.
What was that first interview like then? Daryl?
Hello?
Yes, Daryl.
Can you hear me?
Yes. What was that first interview like?
Well, it was a little tense at first because I told my secretary, you know, see if this guy would meet with me, but do not tell him that I'm black. He'll figure that out, obviously, when he sees me. I didn't want to jeopardize him, by figuring out that I'm black and then not give me the interview. So she didn't tell him, and he didn't ask. And when he showed up, of course, he was surprised. He came with what's called a Grand Nighthawk. And Nighthawk in Klan terminology means bodyguard or security. So the Grand Nighthawk accompanied the Grand Dragon. A Grand Dragon, the term Grand means a state officer. A dragon means like the head of the state. So we would call that a governor. An imperial wizard is like a president. Anybody who's prefixed with the term imperial means he's a national officer. So an imperial Nighthawk would be the bodyguard to the imperial wizard. So this guy, Roger Kelly, was the Grand Dragon for the state of Maryland at that time, and his Grand Nighthawk came, and the Nighthawk was armed. I don't know if Mr. Kelly was armed or not. He came in a suit and tie, and of course, you know, they were all shocked that I was black. But they came in and sat down, and we talked, and there were a couple, you know, tense moments there, but he was very cordial, very cooperative, and I got a lot of information. And, you know, we've kept in contact over the years. Eventually, he left the Klan. He's one of my best friends. We go out and have dinner quite often. I mean, we were even doing that when he was in the Klan. It took a while to get to that point, of course. But today, we know we still get together and go out and have dinner and all that kind of thing. He went on to become an imperial wizard, headed up, you know, the Klan of Maryland and 13 other states. And then when he and I became friends, he disbanded the Klan in Maryland. So today there is no more Ku Klux Klan in the state of Maryland. They've had a couple of attempts at trying to reorganize it, but they've all failed. Now there are some other states, you know, that have held, you know, theirs together that were under Roger Kelly.
We are talking about really erasing racial barriers here on No Limits. To join the conversation, just give us a buzz at 1-866-476-3881. I think this is a good point, Scott, to bring you into the conversation. Could you talk a little bit about the path that led you to the KKK in the first place?
Well, sure. Of course, having a Southern accent, you could probably understand. Of course, I was born and raised in a product of the 1960s, born in 1959. I was in the Mississippi Delta, my hometown, Indianola, Mississippi, which is a hotbed of racial turmoil. I guess, of course, I was first introduced, to the Ku Klux Klan when I was probably in the third grade. I remember studying Mississippi history books, and in the Mississippi history books, they had a chapter on the Ku Klux Klan, and I read about this, and, of course, I was very fascinated by the robes and hoods, and then, of course, as years went on, I heard, the racial turmoil started as, like I said, as being a hotbed. The African-Americans and others coming into the South to gain their rights, and then, of course, the riots. I looked at the Klan as a hero, actually a superhero, because they were there to defend our rights. But I guess it also, stems from, my childhood, the influences of my childhood. I came from an alcoholic family, and I was a very unhappy child. And at the time, I grew up into the public school system. When integration came into the public school system, there was five kids in my family. I had an older sister that was 1 year graduating from high school, and then my older brother was, he was a senior, football, excelled in football and was fixing to graduate with a scholarship. And they came in, and it was really an overwhelming situation. They just came in during integration days and with cotton trailers and just pulled us out of the school. And they said, look, we load your desk onto the cotton trailers, and they took us to private schools. And at the time, of course, my parents were not wealthy. And actually, my parents were not racist of any type, did not teach us any racial issues or anything of that nature. And my parents could not afford to send all four kids to the private school. So I was sent to the African-American schools that actually my town was separated by railroad tracks. The African-Americans lived on one side, the whites lived on the other. That's just the way it was back then. And I had to go down into the African-American section of town to a public school. And I think I was one of about five white students in a school of 300 African-Americans.
Hello?
Hello?
Daryl, you still there?
Yes.
Scott, you're there. Okay. Continue, Scott.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Not a problem.
I thought I lost you. And I was sent down into the African-American section of town and was one of five white students in a school of about 300 African-American students. And see, it's not only a culture shock for white people, and, of course, kids of my age, I think I was like in the sixth grade at the time. It was also a culture shock to the African-American kids, which, at the time we did not really consider that. Mm-hmm. And yes, I was bullied and had physical confrontations, and I think that implanted some negative feelings within myself then. And then as I grew older, being influenced by all the integration and the marches coming into town, and just listening to other people in the community, the way they would blast the African Americans, the Freedom Riders, and the people that were coming in fighting for their rights, affected me. And this, I think, is where my introduction to the race, the racist.
Yes, Daryl did.
That came from.
The call dropped again.
Okay.
We're getting some bleed through here. Scott, go ahead with your story.
Either Scott or John.
For sure. And like I said, I think this is where I was introduced with the racist views of especially the Ku Klux Klan, because they had come into the, section of the state that I lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And at 17 years old, is when I was first actually joined the Ku Klux Klan. I was down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I had a sister in Baton Rouge. The head of the Ku Klux Klan at the time was Bill Wilkerson. He was in Denham Springs, Louisiana. And I searched him out. I found a storefront building on Florida Boulevard that had the Ku Klux Klan name on it. And I just went to his front door and talked to him. And after several conversations with him, I joined the Ku Klux Klan at 17 years old and really was not aware of the scope of the activity that the Ku Klux Klan did. I was just mainly, you know, I looked at them as superheroes.
Scott, that sounds like a good point for us to hold it for just a second. We are talking about erasing racial barriers here on No Limits. My guests are Daryl Davis and Scott Shepard. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about, really, it's racism and how we get past it on No Limits today. My guests are Daryl Davis, an author who is speaking down at Franklin College tonight at 7 p.m., and Scott Shepard, a former KKK Imperial Wizard who has since decided to work toward racial reconciliation. Just before we went to the break, Scott, you were talking about the process by which you joined the KKK, and that really was it was sort of a cultural thing. It sounds like it got linked to some degree in your history and your mind with the disruption that was going on at that period in American history, and in particular in Southern history. What prompted you to leave?
Well, absolutely. That's exactly what, you know, prompted me to join. And of course, there was a combination also of, you know, inner issues that I had, you know, growing up, especially with an alcoholic family and things that, you know, went on as a child. But what prompted me to leave was, you know, of course, over the years, I guess my years in the Klan association was probably a total of about 20 years with this organization. And I can now look back, and during that 20 years, I do remember having some inner conflict, wondering to myself, you know, why am I doing this? Do I really believe the things that I'm preaching? And don't take away from myself, yes, I was a racist, because I was preaching the racism that I had been doing for years and years and years. So I'm not trying to take away from that, because I was 100% blown racist and I was hurting people with words and intimidation. But what prompted me, I would say, was I was in Nashville, Tennessee, and I had been at a restaurant in Nashville, Tennessee, having dinner. And I left that restaurant after having dinner and a few drinks. The law enforcement in Nashville, because I was running for state, I was running for governor of the state of Tennessee at the time, openly as a racist. Mm-hmm. Law enforcement had been watching me. There had been incidences of some mail bombs down in Alabama and Georgia that actually had killed some people and injured people. The FBI had questioned me regarding that, which I didn't have any knowledge of, and play any part of. I think they found out that it was just a lone guy from Alabama from Georgia, that had a beef with the court system and had did this and tried to blame it on racist organizations. But to get back to my exit, I was pulled over by the police, the law enforcement. And when, of course, I remember looking out my back window, and not only did I see blue lights, I saw a sea of blue lights. I mean, I was surrounded. I failed a sobriety test, and they also found a loaded weapon under the front seat of my car. This threw me into the court system in Nashville and Davidson County, Tennessee. After being thrown in the court system, I had an African-American public defender, and I thought to myself, oh, I'm going to be fried. You know, I didn't even think that he would represent me, but he did. And What I did, of course, talking with this attorney, I came up with a plan myself. I said, you know, I'm going to use one of the oldest tactics that's probably been used for years and years and years. I'm going to enroll myself into an alcohol and drug treatment center. And after I get out of this treatment center, when I return to court, I'll have the judge drop these charges and go on with my life as a full-fledged hate-filled racist. What I didn't realize was, you know, at the time that when I entered this Cumberland Heights, the alcohol drug treatment center in Nashville, what I did not realize that when I went inside that place, I came out a different person. I went in one person and came out a different person. Inside the treatment center, I met with one of the doctors, and actually he was the director of Cumberland Heights, and said, look, we've got African Americans here. Are you going to have a problem with that? No, I'm not going to have a problem with it. I want to get in, get out, and go to court and get on with my life. I was exposed to a lot of people of different races, African Americans, people of different religions. We sat down and had intimate conversations with each other and shared our life stories and learned about each other. At the same time, I was exposed to, you know, some counseling with counselors inside the facility. And what I found out was, after doing all this, I found out that my problem, I did not have a problem with people of Africa, you know, people, African Americans, people of color, or different religions. I found out that the problems that I had were within myself. The problem was not other people. The problem was Scott Shepherd. And that's where my transformation, you know, from being a racist and leaving the Klan, you know, where it started was inside that treatment center.
Do you ever find yourself slipping back? Is it something you have to monitor?
Right. Well, actually, I went into this treatment center, and when I got out of the treatment center, like I said, I went in one person and came out another. Sure, there was probably a couple of years there, 2 years, maybe three, but I know there was 2 years that it took me a while to grasp really what had happened to me and the transformation that was going on. And it took me a couple of years to really grasp that, and I still continued a little bit into the racist movement. And then, of course, I returned to Cumberland Heights for another 14-day relapse prevention program to get some more counseling. And at that time, like I said, I was exposed to more counseling and exposed to the people there in the facility. And when I left, that's when I walked away. And, to answer your question, do I find myself slipping back? No, I really haven't found myself slipping back. I did have some guilt of walking away from the people that I had known within the organization, because that is one of their tactics. You know, they take you in and give you a home. They make you feel like family. And the guilt I had was, you know, here I was leaving another family that I had. But then after long thought, soul searching, I realized, you know, these people really weren't my family. You know, they brought me into this organization and indoctrinated me, you know, at such a young age and took advantage of you know, my gullibility and things like that. And I realized they really weren't my friends. So after that, you know, I just walked away and cut ties and haven't looked back since and have no regrets.
We are talking about racism and how to get past it here on No Limits. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Daryl Davis, how common is Scott's story? I mean, from your research, your experiences with this, can you give us some idea? You know, I mean, not to boil down what was a fairly complicated story, it sounds like Scott veered at a fairly young age toward the Klan because he felt somewhat threatened and lonely, and there was a lot of disruption in his personal life. Is that a common path?
that is a common path, but, you know, a Klansman, a Klanswoman, is not stamped out of a standard cookie cutter.
Mm-hmm.
They come from all walks of life. You have those who are highly educated, college graduates. We've had presidents of the United States in the Klan. We've had congressmen, senators, governors. We've also had third-grade dropouts. And, you know, some come from wholesome families. Some come from dysfunctional families. But Scott brings up an excellent point, and that, you know, when he went, you know, he was brought up, you know, around a lot of dysfunctional people, alcoholism, et cetera, and a racist environment. So that, you know, that played a part in his upbringing. But he brings to the point that when he went to this Cumberland Heights rehab center, he was exposed to a different way of life, a life without alcohol, a life around other people who did not look like him. And it opened his eyes. So, you know, exposure is the key thing that brings people out of the Klan. And people join for different reasons. Some join because they had a bad experience with a black person one time. So therefore, all bad people are bad, or all Jewish people are bad because of some deal that went bad with a Jewish person. Some joined for socioeconomic reasons. They might have gotten laid off their job, and they were not racist. But then they get laid off their job, and they get replaced by a black or a Mexican or whatever. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Klan comes in and sees that and says, hey, you know, the blacks got the NAACP and the Jews got the ADL, and, you know, and they're getting all the jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody stands up for the white band, but the Ku Klux Klan, so come join us. We'll get your jobs back so you can put food on your table and pay your mortgage, et cetera, et cetera. So people join for different reasons. But once they get exposed to reality and realize that, you know what, we all came to America. We all came on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. And when they see that and realize that it's better to work together than work against each other, then they begin thinking independently and shedding that brainwashing and leaving the organization. And I got to commend people like you, John, who are bringing people like Scott and I together on your show to talk sense, as opposed to some of these TV shows that bring, you know, the worst of the worst out, and all they do on the show is yell and scream at each other and throw chairs and things like that. Yes, it boosts ratings, and yes, there are people on both sides of different races who behave like that in the Klan or black people or whatever. But they are brought together for a certain purpose to establish, you know, ratings. And that's not accomplishing anything, even though that's how they are. But you're bringing people together to talk sensibly about what we can do to curb racism is the best way to get people out. Well, and people hearing Scott's message, hearing, you know, in what I go through, what I do, that helps a lot, and you are the instigator of that.
Well, thanks very much for the kind words, but that's sort of WFYI's mission here, is to make sure that there's thoughtful discourse on the air. I'd like to talk a little bit, Daryl, about how you structure. I mean, the Roger Kelly story could have been, you know, just a single incident, but this has become, you know, kind of a mission for you. And I would think after a while, I mean, Roger Kelly went into that meeting not knowing who he was meeting with. After a while, you stop being able to surprise people, I would think.
Yeah.
How do you structure the conversations with people who determined not to think of you as a human being?
Well, you know, when you talk with somebody one-on-one, instead of us, you know, you're talking. They understand your language. You understand their language. And you find that you have more in common with each other than you do in contrast. You may not agree, or they may not agree. Say, let's say, for example, you know, they're talking with you and having a good conversation. They may not agree on interracial dating or interracial marriage, something like that. Okay, she said, okay, fine. You know, I have no problem with interracial marriage. Okay, you got a problem with it? All right, that's fine. We'll leave that alone. But what about kids getting drugs on the street or getting a bad education? Oh, well, I'm against that. You know, we need to get drugs off the street. Well, guess what? I believe that too. So let's take that commonality and let's work on that. Let's work on that together. So when you find things you have in common and you begin to work together on that, the things that you had in contrast, like interracial couples, things like that, or the fact that you're Jewish or you're Catholic or you're Muslim, whatever, you know, those things tend to fall by the wayside because because you're working for the common goal. And you realize this person wants the same thing for him and his family as you want for your family. So what's the difference?
Well, and I guess where I'd like to go is where how you get past that kind of distrust. I mean, as you said in that first meeting with Kelly, he brought a bodyguard with him. I presume you don't have bodyguards with you.
I do not.
Have there been times when you felt frightened for your safety? Or...
Well, there have been times when I had to fight and put somebody in the hospital and put somebody in jail because I was attacked. You know, and fortunately, I won on the street and I won in court. But, you know, that doesn't happen very often. You know, every now and then, you know, there's somebody who just hates that much just to look at you. You know, they want to attack you. You know, and there, you know, there will be people who will go to their grave hating and being violent. You know, and those people, you know, they just simply cannot change. You see, you have people, John, who are ignorant. You have people who are stupid. Mm-hmm. You have them in all races. Mm-hmm. And some people define ignorance and stupidity as being synonymous. I don't. For me, an ignorant person is someone who makes the wrong decision because he or she does not have the facts and proper information to make the right decision. A stupid person is someone who has the right information to make the right decision, but still does not do it and makes the wrong decision. So fortunately, there is a cure for ignorance, and that cure is education. You present people with the proper information and the facts, and then you alleviate them of their ignorance. But if you present someone who is stupid with the facts and they still behave stupidly, there's nothing you can do. There's no cure for stupidity.
In terms of making an assessment, because you talk about how there are some people, you know, who are just determined. They're going to go to their graves with their hearts filled
right.
with hate. How do you make a judgment, you know, when you're talking with this person saying, you know, conceivably, this is someone I could reach. And when do you just say, nope, lost cause, walk away?
Well, actually, I'm the eternal optimist. I keep trying with the people who some you know end up in their grave hating, or I know they will go there. But I don't give up on them. I'm not somebody who gives up. You know, I never set out to convert anybody. That wasn't my mission. My mission was really to figure out, how do I, you know, how do you hate me when you don't even know me? Just tell me that so I can understand that. And that's what I want to do, you know, meeting with people all around the country who belong to the Klan or neo-Nazis or whatever. I wasn't out to convert them. But then in sitting down and talking with them and you finding out that, you know, that you've got a lot in common, more so than you do in contrast, with what you had in contrast than around race. They thought that their race was superior to your race. They thought the races had to be apart. You know, I felt my race was equal to their race, and the races could be together. Other than that, we had a lot in common. Like I talked about education or getting drugs, you know, out of the community or whatever. And then they would become my friends. And I thought, wow, you know, this is amazing. So I'm going to keep on doing this because, you know, we're raised to think, you know, that a tiger can't change its stripes. But I saw the stripes changing. And so I keep on doing that. And the most important thing is this. When two enemies are talking, they're not fighting. It's when the talking ceases that the ground becomes fertile for violence. But as long as you have two enemies talking to each other, I mean, they can be disagreeing and all that, that's fine. But as long as they're communicating, they're not fighting. So you keep those lines of communication open, and hopefully something will snap, something will break, and somebody will see the light.
We are talking about erasing racial barriers here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Daryl Davis, who is an author, civil rights activist, musician, and actor. He's speaking down at Franklin College this evening at 7 p.m. about this subject. And Scott Shepard, who is a former KKK Imperial Wizard and is now working toward achieving racial reconciliation. I am John Krall. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about racism and how we get past it today on No Limits. My guests are author and activist Daryl Davis and Scott Shepard, a former KKK member who is now working toward racial reconciliation. I guess I want to, here in Indiana, we've talked about how, you know, the things that divide human beings. We've obviously got a huge statewide debate right now on the issue of same-sex marriage that has really divided people, created an awful lot of anger. Do either of you see any parallels between that, you know, that debate and the civil rights struggles that we went through? Daryl, I'll start with you.
People try to parallel them. And to some degree, they're parallel, but in many degrees, they're not parallel, because you're talking about the color of someone's skin as opposed to their gender. Black people having the same rights as white people, whether you're male or female, or marrying interracially or something like that, as opposed to two members of the same sex getting married. Discrimination is discrimination by any means, but I don't really see a strong parallel myself.
Scott, how about you?
I guess I would have to agree with Daryl on that. I really don't see a strong parallel. I will say that, you know, of course, in my issues within myself, my hatred and, well, I won't say really hatred, my problems did spill over, you know, or towards gay people also. Not only did I direct, you know, anger and, well, yes, hatred towards African-Americans, people of color, I did, was pretty harsh towards gay people also. But I don't see really a parallel to it. But, you know, my issues did spill over, and I did, you know, intimidate and have some ill feelings towards gay people at the time.
Scott, have you encountered any people from your previous life? I mean, that you say you tried to intimidate or that you had harsh feelings toward, and if so, how do you deal with them?
How do I deal with the feelings that I had?
No, the people, if you encounter them from that previous life.
Oh, if I encounter them,
yeah,
today,
how do you...
from my previous life, if you're talking about the people that I intimidated and I had ill feelings to, I have gone to, you know, great lengths to make amends and apologies. I've contacted people that I knew that I had said things and hurt, and just people that had come across in my life that I know that hurt. And I'll give one example. Of one was a news lady here in Memphis, Tennessee, where I was very active for Channel 5. And I contacted her several years ago, and I contacted her and I told her, you know, I apologize. She was African-American and was married to a white gentleman. And I made apologies to her. And she told me, she said, you know, Scott, she said, during those years, I sometimes wondered if you would ever change, or if you would change. And today, you know, she's one of my best friends, Kim Clark, Channel 5. And yes, I've been very well received by a lot of the people that I said things and hurt, and have received forgiveness from them. And there's probably no way that I'll be able to reach all the people, and I know there's not. I will be apologizing for the rest of my life, and that's okay too. And I pretty much have forgiven myself, but I still hold some guilt, and I'm not complaining about that guilt that I hold, because I feel like that guilt that I still have within myself some gives me more of a driving force to keep going and moving and trying to make reconciliation with, you know, with the other races. So yes, I've come across some of them and have made amends with them. And I hope that continues. I hope I can, you know, continue to be able to do that.
We are talking about getting past racism here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 1-866-472-5787. 476-3881. Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I think one of the things that could help get rid of racism in America is the educational system. I think the schools, the way that they teach about teach the American history and so-called black history, helps to keep racism going. It helps, it continues to feed into the superior, inferior ways of looking at the races. So if we could ever start with, and getting beyond King, you know, Martin Luther King was a great man, did great things, but we have a lot of black people from the time we arrived in this country to today who have done great things, and we shouldn't just get stuck on just one person and what they did. But starting with the schools and the educational system.
And just to make sure that I understand your point and your concern, Linda.
Oh, I understand her perfectly.
Yeah, no, I think I do too. I want to draw it out. I want to draw it out for the audience. Two is, as I hear, one, there's not enough exploration of black Americans' contribution to American history. But two, yeah, it's also the
in
fact
the
that it's separate in the schools, and that also that it's separated and treated as its own separate entity rather than these are contributions to American history.
Well, just teaching history, period. There
yeah.
shouldn't be, as far as America goes,
yeah.
there shouldn't be a white history and a black history.
That's what
there
I was trying to draw out of you.
History.
Yeah, that's what
you
I was trying to
American
draw out
history,
of you.
You include everybody.
Yes.
Right. And
thanks
let
very
me
much for the call, Linda.
You're welcome.
Linda is absolutely right about that. And I've been saying that for 13 years. Now, at one time, there was a need for Black History Month. Because no black history was being taught. American history, you might as well have to say white history. And white people were being credited with things that they did not invent and that they did not discover. You know, and we were being denied, you know, our credibility.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to fight to get history into the schools. And so, you know, we had that one. Well, first it started with a week. It was called Negro History Week.
Mm-hmm.
And we fought harder and we got a whole month. But now we've become complacent, and we need to get rid of that month and take what is learned in that month and spread it out throughout the year. Because all year long, we learn about Thomas Edison, Benjamin Franklin, Eli Whitney, Alexander Graham Bell, on and on and on about all these great white contributors to American history. But every February, we only learn about a half a dozen black people. Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver, and maybe one or two others. And by the time we get to half a dozen, guess what? The month is over. We already did our black thing. Let's move on. So subliminally, we are brainwashing in the educational system. We're brainwashing little black kids and little white kids into believing there were only a handful of black people in this country that ever did anything. I'm not taking anything away from the people that I just named. There's the greatest and all that kind of stuff. But what about the guy who invented the traffic light? What about the man who invented the ironing board? They were black. How come we never talk about them? How come we never talk about the Tulsa race riots? Because we don't have time in February. But guess what? Black people are black all, you know, 12 months of the year. March is Women's History Month. We don't, you know, we don't talk about Betsy Ross and Clara Barton during the month of March. No. We should incorporate them into American history as well. Spread it out throughout the year. If we're going to move forward, like I said, there was a time we needed that month because nothing was being taught. But haven't we come beyond that time yet? Just like the Miss Black America pageant. We needed Miss Black America pageant because black girls were not allowed to compete in Miss America. Finally, when Miss America opened its doors to allow anybody who was American, regardless of color, to compete for Miss America, then we no longer need Miss Black America. And since then, we've had a few Miss Americas who've been black, like Vanessa Williams and Debbie Turner and whoever else. So why can't we move forward and assimilate what's being taught during Black History Month into the general American history where it belongs and include more people? When Obama leaves office, are we only going to talk about the first black president during the month of February, put him in the February box?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense? It's ludicrous. We need to move beyond that now.
We are talking about how we erase racial barriers, get past racial animosity here on No Limits. Robert, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Oh, thank you.
I'll be real brief. I'll just make a quick comment. I wanted to add to the previous female caller who talked about the history, the dual histories that we teach in school. And I think one of the things that also plagues people of color, as well as Caucasian Americans, is that we just don't expect enough out of the kids in the inner cities and the educational system. The standards, even though they may be, on paper, set the same as they are, and maybe kids living in Carmel or wherever they may be. But we just don't expect as much from them because we look at them as being inner-city kids, when I think they're just as smart and just as capable as doing the same amount of work, scoring the same kind of grades, get into the same colleges as the kids in the suburbs. But we just think just because they live in the inner city and they attend IPS, they're not as capable as the kids that live in Carmel or Franklin Township or Pike or Lawrence or wherever it may be. So that was my comment. I just think that we just don't expect enough. And I think if we did expect more, maybe not make things tougher, but, really drove home the point that, success-wise and sticking with things, sticking with education and getting your high school degree, I think we'd see a whole big difference in outcomes.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Robert. That's actually a persistent theme. We've been talking about, the hard and concrete forms of racial bigotry. There is an argument out there that the low expectations and all of that are a soft form. Daryl, could you respond to Robert?
Yeah, I can only hear him partially, but yeah, I think I understand, what he was saying, that, that we pass judgment based upon somebody's environment, and, you're judged by the company you keep, more or less. And yes, I think, schools should be stronger, and we should teach people to expect more, not lower the standards, but bring people up, because people become a product of their environment. And I go back to Scott talking about the environment in which he was raised, and he had to break away from that. If we can change the environment for these people of the inner city or trailer park or whatever else, make our schools more welcoming and address, don't just teach the subject, teach the child. You understand the difference? When we do that, then we can change where, their future. Because if all we do is just teach the subject and they just go back, to their own environment, then it's harder for them to break away and become somebody because they become a product of that cycle. But if we teach not only the subject but teach the child, address, their shortcomings, et cetera, then they have a greater chance for a future.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Gideon who says, I was wondering why there was such great hate towards African-Americans back in the KKK days. And I guess if I might get in, I'm going to ask these guys to answer that question, but also ask, it's not back in the day. I think you both would argue that the KKK is still an active presence today.
Yes.
Absolutely, yes.
In fact, it's even greater today. It's growing today because we have Obama in office, and who would have dreamed of a black man being president? Also, illegal immigration is a big concern to the KKK and members or people of the same type of mindset. But however, when the KKK or like-minded people use the term illegal immigration, they use that as one of their recruiting tools, where they say, hey, we're against illegal immigration also. Come join us and we'll fight it together. But when they use the term illegal immigration, it's kind of a code term for Hispanic people, because there are plenty of Canadians here in this country who are here illegally. There are plenty of people who are here from the UK and Eastern Europe. But because they look like the majority of people here, then it's okay. But when you look different and you realize that some of these people might be marrying your daughters or your sons or whatever, it raises concern. When I was back in the 60s, when I was in elementary school and stuff, Scott and I are around the same age. I'm 55. He's 54. When we were kids, the black population in the U.S. was 12%. Hispanics were 2%. Native Americans, 1.9%. And Asians, around 2%, 3%. Today, black people are still 12%. Hispanics are now 13%. Mm-hmm. So you've got now 25% non-white. Back in the day, at 12%, blacks were the biggest nemesis for people in the Klan and like-minded people. And now you got 25% non-white. So they see their number going down slowly, and people of color, that their number coming up. And in the next few generations, it's going to be 50-50. And then eventually, people who are white are going to be the minority. It's going to flip-flop. And that's of a grave concern, because when you have been in the seat of power and you've sat on the throne for hundreds of years, you don't want to get off.
We're getting a little bit close on time, but I wanted to raise this point, because we are talking sort of about where the KKK and white supremacist groups are now. I remember 20 years ago or so when David Duke was running for governor and running for president, there was a lot of talk about how there was a new, you know, sort of more media-friendly KKK and all of that, that it was becoming more media-savvy. Where is the KKK going now, and how should we deal with it? We've got probably about a minute, minute and a half on this.
I'll let Scott answer that.
Scott?
Well, pretty much, I tell you, of course, the Klan uses legitimate issues like illegal immigration, drugs in the streets, different legitimate causes, you know, that people are concerned about. And I think that's one of the reasons that they're growing so, you know, so fast now, because they're latching on some of these issues. And personally, you know, I know some of these organizations, they really could care less about some of these, the drug problems. These are just code words and code issues that they use to try to boost their membership to grow for the racist issues. So this, you know, this is one of the things that's causing them to, you know, to grow, and they're going to continue to grow, you know, as long as we don't have people sitting down, of course, like Daryl, and, you know, of course, myself, you know, sit down and educating people. I mean, the key is sitting down, talking with other people of other races and getting to know them, which I did within this alcohol and drug treatment facility. And until we can do that, you know, I believe they're going to continue to grow, but we've got to really sit down and talk with people. And I do not want to be an adversary or go nose to nose with the Ku Klux Klan. You know, that is not my goal. My goal is to, you know, to educate and try to draw people out of these organizations and prevent people from going into these organizations with, you know, with my story and trying to get the point across of why people do this. And, you know, like I said, until we can educate people and sit down and talk and get to know each other, I think they're going to continue to grow.
That'll have to be the last word. Daryl Davis and Scott Shepard, thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Allseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.